new year. Welcome back to the Send Mum Club for 2026. I'm not going to lie, it's taken me a little bit longer to get going than I'd hoped, but here we go. So a little life update from me. Leo started preschool and he looked such a big boy walking in. I found it really hard because he's been with me almost exclusively for the last 3 and a bit years. So he goes to a childminder who's my friend in the morning, but only for a couple of hours while I'm on the radio, like literally 2 hours. And then I'm with him for the rest of the day. So to drop him off and leave him for what would it have been, about 6 hours, felt really alien and strange to me. He was fine. I obviously cried, as I knew that I would. And then I went home and did loads of work and tried to take my mind off it and counted down the hours until I picked him up again. But it seemed to go really well. I mean, in terms of speech and language, we're at the beginning of that process. And Leo's getting really good. He can tell us what he wants and what he doesn't want, very vocally what he doesn't want. But we aren't really yet at that stage of kind of having a conversation. So I can't really say, well, I can say to him, what did you do today? It's just he won't tell me. So that feels a little strange that he spent a whole 6 hours away from me and I can't be like, who did you play with? What did you do? Did you like your lunch? He just stares at me quite blankly, to be honest, and then babbles. It did make me feel better though. Well, better and not better. So when I went to pick him up on his first day, he's doing 2 days a week. So I went on Tuesday to pick him up and I was like, oh my God, hi, have you had a lovely day? And he turned around and tried to walk back in, which is great because obviously he's happy there, but also like, I'd like you to miss me a little bit. Right, on to this week's episode. And I'm joined by Steph Logan. She is here to talk about her daughter Lola, who has autism and quite a lot of sensory needs. Now, Steph slid into my DMs and asked to come on the podcast, which I'm always up for and I absolutely love. If you're not following, by the way, I am at the Send Mum Club on Instagram. And Steph has a page which highlights places, I mean, just on Merseyside, because that's where she lives, but that have specific SEND sessions, or maybe they are exclusively for SEND children. And she's kind of helping other people find appropriate days out and places that are really inclusive and welcoming. So I love that vibe. So we do talk about that. We don't go into too much detail because obviously a lot of people aren't in Merseyside, but we talk about the importance of having those places. And not just for the kids, the importance for the parents as well. That was a really interesting conversation we had about that. We also talk about the fact that Steph has worked in SEND for years, but the older end. So she works in supporting young adults post 16. So we have a really insightful chat there about what that looks like and in terms of getting work experience and paid employment when our children grow up. And I really appreciated Steph sharing her knowledge on that as well. So I'm going to stop telling you what we talked about and just let you listen to what we talked about. Okay, here we go. Here's the episode. Steph, you are my first guest of 2026. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, it's lovely to chat to you. So we've actually met briefly, haven't we? It was a messy play, wasn't it?
Yeah, a very, very messy play.
Very messy play. It's the kind of thing, I think, that maybe there are better mums than me, but I wouldn't dream of setting that up in my house. So it's lovely to go to somewhere else where they clean it up afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. Because I remember, because I think we had like a brief chat because we were both in the same sort of situation because both of our kids were very, very messy.
Oh my God. Yeah, they were filthy, weren't they? And stupidly, because I hadn't taken him to messy play before, I hadn't taken a change of clothes. So then I just had this absolutely like, he was covered in like flour and jelly and everything in my clean car, which wasn't ideal. And it was lesson learned from me. I've got two older kids. You think I'd know better than this, but no.
Oh, but they loved it, didn't they?
Yeah, it was really cute, actually. So Steph, you are here to talk about your daughter Lola, who's 6. Mm-hmm. So before we get into any kind of diagnosis or anything like that, what's Lola like?
So Lola is very, very energetic. She's just a bundle of joy. Honestly, she's amazing. She is very much, although she's not great with kids, she's very much a people person. She'll come up and just give you a cuddle. She just loves to be involved in things, loves to be in the centre. She's very hyperactive, very impulsive, but she's just amazing.
So is she better with adults than other children?
Yeah, definitely. yeah, she wouldn't really go towards another child in like play or like for cuddles or anything, but with adults she loves them.
Lola has autism. Yep. And sensory needs as well. Is there a diagnosis of us as like a sensory processing disorder or something like that?
No, not a formal diagnosis, but it's like written in like her EHCP. She, across all the different sensory areas, she's a massive sensory seeker. So she doesn't really avoid many things. Sometimes noise a little bit, but she just loves it. She's constantly wanting to like spin or climb or get that. She just needs lots of input. So yeah, we have to keep her busy, keep her moving, just to fulfill those sensory needs, which is hard and tiring.
Well, yeah. Can we just go back to the beginning and kind of tell me your journey with Lola?
Lola, when she was a baby, she started hitting like her milestones in terms of like she was a very early like walker. She was saying words before she turned one, so we never really like noticed anything. And then when we got to about 18 months, she'd lost every single word that she had, and that's when we started to sort of like notice like, oh, something's, you know, a little bit different here. So obviously we went to the health visitor, but she was born in 2020, so we were like saying things like, oh well, it's because she's not socialising. So when she starts to go to Childminder, we just thought that she would naturally pick up those words and pick up those social skills when she was around other children and more people. But then they obviously started to notice, you know, the differences and the getting her to do certain things, like struggles with like transitions, you know, just generally her just wanting to do her own thing. Because that is basically what Lola's like. She always just wants to do her own thing. She's got her own agenda. So they picked up on that, and then the health visitor did it when she was two. So they sent us to all like the general like workshops, and that's when we sort of started on the pathway, probably when she was about 2.5. And then she was four, I think, four, nearly five when she got a diagnosis. So yeah, it was just all of those words that she had. She'd lost, and she then went to a nursery, and she really, really struggled in that environment where it was loud and there was lots of children there. She found it really difficult. I'd say most days we would get phone calls after about half an hour saying she's just crying, she wants to just be in the office. She didn't like to sort of be around all the other children. So that's when obviously we realised, you know, there was something there. And I've actually worked in SEN for 14 years now. So, but I've always worked with young people, so they've always been teenagers. So I was like, I don't know what a child with autism is like. And I knew a lot of like the process. I knew about autism, do you know what I mean? But I didn't know what a 2-3-year-old, 4-year-old with autism was like, because I'd never been around that. So even though I had the knowledge, I didn't really fully understand all those different things, and especially not about the sensory processing needs. Like that was just like, it was an eye opener, because it drives a lot of what Lola does. So we had to learn how to manage it and how to give her that input to enable her to be happy and settled and fulfilled, and actually to help her to sleep as well, because that's a major thing, trying to get Lola asleep, because she just always wants to be involved in something, always wants to be on the go, always wants to be with us.
And the sleep issue is quite a common thing, isn't it, that I hear from quite a lot of people. Can she get to sleep but can't stay asleep, or is it just all of it?
Hers is mainly getting to sleep. She'll find a million different things to do rather than going to sleep. Even if we know she's tired, she'll be like, oh, I want this toy, a toy that she's probably never played with for a year. She'll suddenly have a fascination with it. Or she'll just go into like fits of laughter, or she'll even do things like she'll pinch her eyelids to try and keep herself awake. Once we get her asleep, she's generally, touch wood, generally okay. But she will, if she wakes, if something wakes her, then we'd probably be awake for 2 or 3 hours, because it's that, again, going back through the process of getting her back asleep.
I am extremely lucky that I have children that sleep. It's me that's the issue. So for as long as I can remember, probably once I got out of that teenage stage of being able to sleep forever, I suffer with insomnia.
Oh.
So I would never minimize going, oh God, it's just sleep. Like when you are sleep deprived, I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I feel like it literally kind of sometimes sucks the joy out of everything if you haven't slept properly. Like, how do you find that, especially with you saying that Lola needs so much input and she's got so much energy? Do you find that tough, the lack of sleep?
Oh, yeah, it's so hard. If we've had a bad night, it's not like she won't feel it. She won't notice if she's only had 3 or 4 hours sleep. She will be, no, I'm awake. We want to do all of our normal things. Whereas I'll just be like, or me or dad will be like, you know, maybe just chill. We'll just have a day in or whatever. But she's like, no, she still wants to go full pelt. She wants to do everything. And I always think, oh, she, at some point she's going to like crash and she's going to have a nap. But no, she'll power through. So,
oh, that's
yeah.
So hard.
Yeah, I'd say we're probably spend most of our money in the local coffee shop.
Have any health professionals kind of, have you had any intervention with sleep? Have they suggested things? Have you tried things that haven't worked? Or like, how has that been for you?
We have just managed most of that ourselves. We try and get her into a good sort of nighttime routine and we trial our own sort of things. Like, we would never dream of trying to get her asleep at like 7 o'clock at night because it would be awful for us. We'd be in a constant battle. So we've just found our own sort of rhythm with it. We know that the sort of like between 8 and half 8, she'll start to wind down. And I'd say it might be an hour and a half to get her asleep. We've sort of just got our own routine. And for other people, like I think for people whose kids aren't like that, they'd be like, oh, I couldn't do that. But we've just got into our own little way of doing it. And we just share the bedtimes, you know, between me and her dad. So we've never had any external support because I think you have to be in quite dire need to get it because it's so hard to get any support with sleep.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's interesting. I didn't know that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really difficult. It's another battle that sends mums and dads have to go through. And sometimes you just think, oh, I don't know if that's
just too tired.
Yeah. I don't think I can make that phone call today or write that email.
How was the school process for you? Does she go to mainstream or is she in a specialist provision?
She's in a mainstream school, but in a specialist like class. That's amazing. It's really close to our house. So when she was just before she turned 4, we were living in Manchester. We moved from Manchester back to closer to my family. The house that we found was around the corner from this school, which is absolutely amazing. We got her into the nursery there. And I'm sure she won't mind me saying, but the nursery teacher has 2 autistic children. And we met her and it was just like, this was meant to be. And she went in there and went into the nursery and she just settled like so well. And then she got into the school there. So it's just like, just absolutely amazing. She loves going to school now. We've never had 1 phone call to say, you know, come and pick her up. She's not like settling or anything. They know her little quirks, they know her needs, they know what she needs at certain times, if she needs a sensory circuit. Like when she first started nursery, her sensory needs was ripping paper. So she would literally have a basket full of paper that she could just rip. And they said, it's fine as long as she puts it into the basket, she takes it out and puts it back in. And that was like amazing. She just had that little, she'd have 15 minutes where she'd just sit there and rip paper. Just because that settled her, and then she'd carry on with her day.
Because you know, like you mentioned there, the teacher obviously understood what that was. Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe if she'd been in a different setting,
that
possibly would have been a slightly different outcome. Mm-hmm. Of would she have been able to sit there and do that to regulate or not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I just think because with having the autism base like attached to the school as well, all of the staff are fully on board, and even all of the children as well. And that's what I love about the school, because, say, it is a mainstream school, but they know all of the kids that do, the autistic children that are part of the base, and they understand that that's what they need. So they used to seeing them with, like, ear defenders on, or, you know, using, like, the sensory toys and things like that. And it's really good for them to understand, because as much as, like, you know, we're supporting our kids, we have to support other people and other children to understand what our children need, and to see them and be like, oh yeah, they go to my school. And it's just like, that's normal, and that's what we should strive for, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that's something that's possibly overlooked sometimes, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You obviously, and rightly so, people are concentrating on their own children and what they need, as you should. But it's an interesting point, because that really is proper inclusivity, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it not being the exception? Is that just being the norm? And I think the younger other children see that, growing up with that, it becomes something that they're just, it's not really anything important to them, is it?
No. And they'll see it in other kids. They might be out at a playground or in a play centre, and they'll see a child with ear defenders on, and they'll be like, oh, that's like such and such in my school. And they understand what it is, and they become accepting. And kids are just, they pick up things so much better than adults, don't they?
Yeah, and I think it's really nice actually to hear that you are having a really lovely school experience, mm-hmm. because I've spoken to lots of other parents who have had a fight to get in, or when they get in, it's not the right setting. So I feel like it's nice to hear that positive story, mm-hmm. of you just having this, you know, great experience, and she loves going in. That's fantastic. So, Steph, you mentioned that you've worked in SEND for years, but with, did you say young adults or older children?
Yeah, so in post-16.
When Lola was started on the pathway and, you know, autism was mentioned, do you feel like it was good that you kind of had this insight into what that could look like into the future? Or do you think that maybe worried you a bit more? It's hard sometimes, isn't it? Because you think knowledge is power, yeah. But then also I think maybe sometimes you can know too much and it can be slightly detrimental. How did you find that?
I think I definitely have days where I feel both. So sometimes I'm like, oh yeah, well, I know that because of, it reminds me of, you know, a certain person that I've worked with, so I know what to do. But then other times, yeah, I'm like, oh, and I do have those days of like panic, but I definitely do feel like having that knowledge has helped massively. And like my husband will like ask me questions, and I think sometimes I forget sort of how little other people know. So I just presume, I go, oh, I thought you'd just know that, because you know when it's your something that you do day in day out, you forget that's not something that everybody knows. So yeah, it's definitely helped a lot. And say I can speak to my husband about things and tell him things, and it might be that I can explain something rather than him having to go and sit in a workshop. I can just sort of like show him like different videos or signpost him to certain things, or just explain what something means or what it looks like. Rather than him having to go to sort of professionals to find out that information.
That's so interesting. I haven't kind of come across that situation before, because I feel like the majority of people that I have spoken to anyway, either they have, we'll use autism as an example because that's what we're mm-hmm. talking about with Lola. And I feel like most people either have experience because somebody in their family might have autism, or they might have friends or friends' children, or people have zero knowledge at all, mm-hmm. where you've kind of got it in a professional capacity. And it's interesting you saying like pointing him to, you know, videos or signposting him to something else. Like that's actually, he's kind of really lucky to have that, I guess. Yeah. But me and my husband were just like, okay, we have no idea about Down syndrome. What do we do now?
But also I found that it's helped me in my professional life as well. You know, just generally like working with the parents and also with the teachers, because I sort of have this bit of a motto that if it's not good enough for Lola, then it's not going to be good enough for the young people that I work with. So if I see somebody doing something, I will, you know, I mean, as always say it anyway, but it needs to be good enough for your child, doesn't it? So it's definitely helped me in that way. And even just from finding out different stuff from professionals and going to different things for Lola, I've gone, oh yeah, that's what these parents have been through. I'd never sort of realised that before, the fight that they'd gone through for 16 years by the time they've got to me. And obviously by the time they got to me, a lot of the time they've got their EHCP in place, they've got all the support, they've got the medication. So it's not so much in terms of that the fighting, but they've been through so much for years and spoken to so many different people and had to tell their story so many times that now I'm so much more mindful of that when I'm asking them questions, because you probably get it yourself. You think, oh, I've got to go through the same sort of questions about the pregnancy. What was your pregnancy like? And, you know, going through all of that, you think, I've answered these questions so many times. And that's what I'm definitely more mindful of when I'm at work, because I'm like thinking, oh, do you know what? They've said this to so many different people. They've been to so many meetings. They've had all of this. What can I do to actually help them here?
I think sometimes, though, you feel that sense of relief when you're talking to a health professional or somebody involved in your child's care, knowing that they have that lived experience. Mm-hmm. So you're giving that to their parents, just like Lola's teacher gave it to you.
Yeah.
Because that must have felt so lovely for you, knowing that she got it, mm-hmm. and you didn't have to explain it all.
Yeah.
You can kind of just relax a little bit and you know that you're on the same page. So I think it's lovely that you are giving that to people, mm-hmm. but it's also lovely that you were getting it from school as well.
Yeah, definitely.
That's really nice. Can I ask, because I think a lot of parents who listen to this podcast tend so far, and probably that's because of the guests that I've had on, to be honest, but they tend to have younger children, mm-hmm. you know, like me and you. Lola's 6, Leo's 3. And the majority of mums who I've spoken to so far, they are on the younger end of the scale. But given what you do for work, how is that support post 16? Because having had a very brief conversation with a couple of people, 16 seems to be a key point in where things change. Because is that the age where the disability living allowance changes?
Yeah.
I don't know if all children's hospitals are the same. I can only speak from my own experience, but Alder Hey only take up to 16, don't they? So
sometimes they will stay with them until 18, for if they're under a certain doctor or a certain team. But yeah, generally between like 17, 18, they'll start moving into adult services.
So what would you say to, I suppose, yourself, but also to somebody listening to this who does have a child with specifically autism? Like, how does it look once they turn 16?
The main thing I'd say is that to have aspirations for your child, because there's so many things out there and it's improving year on year. You know, I've worked a lot on supporters internships and I've helped a lot of young people get into the workplace. There is this support there. I think a lot of people just think, oh, they're going to go into sort of like a daycare sort of like centre and be doing things like that. But I'm always like, everyone has the ability to work. They just have to have the support there. They need the support, and we need to educate more employers, because often a lot of employers that we get on board is because they've, like me and you, had some sort of lived experience where either their child has got a disability or they've got someone in the family, and then they'll be like, oh, we really want to do this because we know how much it's going to help. So I feel like that's often a foot in the door in a lot of places, and a lot of the time the employers absolutely love it. Like when our young people, when our learners go into the workplaces, they love having them on the team because it just brings such a new perspective and a new way of thinking. And so many people have come up to me and said, when they've had someone on work placement with them or they've gone into a job, oh, do you know what, I was quite bored in my job and then I started working with this young person and I was teaching them, and it's like they've taught me things. And they've brought us a new perspective and how grateful like our young people are to be in the workplace and to have a job. So it really does help. So there is a lot out there. So that's what I always say to people, like, there are things out there that the future doesn't have to be bleak. Just challenge them, like challenge your child, your young person, get them out of the comfort zone. So don't think, oh, they can't do that. We always use a thing like presume competence, like presume they can do it, but it's just the support they need, scaffold the support, put that in place, and then gradually phase it away. It honestly can work.
And what is the situation with paid employment? Because obviously recently, it was just before Christmas, wasn't there? Was it Waitrose? There was that big story.
Yeah.
There was, if you haven't seen this story, I'll just remind you quickly. It was a young lad, wasn't it, with autism, mm-hmm. and he'd been working voluntarily at Waitrose. And then I think, did his mum ask for him to start being paid? And they were like, sorry, we can't do that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that they had their side, and, you know, it's probably slightly more complex than that. But that kind of highlighted this issue where are people actually being paid to do work mm-hmm. that somebody without a disability would 100% be paid for? What do you kind of think on that?
Yeah, so the way we've always done it is that the placement would only be for a certain amount of time. So the idea is they would go in to learn the job and have that time to, so it might take a few months to learn the job, and they can demonstrate and show their skills in the workplace. So like the example of that young man, If they knew he could do those tasks and he was doing it voluntarily and they were happy to have him there voluntarily, he should have been getting paid. Waitrose are a very, very rich company. It's not like it's somewhere, a charity, where he's going in and helping because they don't have much money and they need the help there. It's, you know, he should have been getting paid for that. So we do a lot of like things called working interviews. So say they can go in and it might be all the same things on an interview, like checklists that they want to be able to demonstrate, but they might do that over 4 weeks. So going and doing it in real life as opposed to sitting in an interview where, especially with autism, a lot of autistic people aren't going to cope very well in that situation. They're not going to be able to sit there and make eye contact with a panel and give like experiences and tell their story, but they could go in and actually do that job and show that they're able to do it and show that they can turn up on time, show they can work in a team, work independently. So I was thinking, well, that's such a better way of doing it, actually going in and proving it. But it's often HR departments where they go, oh, we have to do an interview. So that's where there is a lot of education needed with companies, because I was thinking, well, they've proven it. What difference does it make if they sit down for half an hour and tell you that they can do it? Because anyone could do that. Anyone could go into an interview and say, oh, I can do this job and say they can do it. But actually going into the workplace and doing it is quite different, isn't it?
Oh, 100%. I've definitely done interviews for jobs before where I've absolutely blagged that I can do things that I've never done before. Because of course you're going to say yes if someone's like, you need this to do the job, can you do it? You're like, yeah, of course I can, it'll be fine.
Yeah, so yeah, there are, say, there's lots of organisations that are really getting on board now. Yeah, so support internships is definitely something that people should look into.
I'd like to talk to you about social connections and how you found that since having Lola, mm-hmm. because I'm guessing that because she is so sensory seeking, is it more difficult to hang out with friends who've got children who don't have those additional needs?
Yeah, definitely. Especially in like during half terms and weekends, because I'm always like, where are we going to go where Lola's going to be able to cope? Because going to a traditional play centre on a weekend with Lola, just the thought of it, like if it's not a dedicated send session, it just gives me so much anxiety. So going somewhere with our friends who, you know, children don't have disabilities, like there's so many more things that I would need to think about than they would. Like, they would just book it, just turn up, go, and often sit there with a cup of tea and the children would be off playing. And I'd be like, no, I can't do that. Going to a play centre for me is like going to the gym, because I will be up and down and, you know, I've got to go around with Lola. Like, unless it's a send session, often sometimes then that's fine. But I would be far too nervous of not being able to see her if she was up in, you know, in a soft play. Also, just me having to look around and see what are the risks, what could potentially happen. Is there an escape route? Is there a way she could sort of get out? Lola also likes, she loves fizzy drinks. It's not something we get in the house, but she's discovered that she knows what a can of Coke looks like and she loves it. So if she sees someone with it, she doesn't know that that's not hers. She will go over to a table and just start drinking someone's drink. So in a play centre, people are just sort of like looking at me like, why is your child drinking my drink? So all of that, it's, and I'm constantly, I'm saying like, sorry, oh, sorry, Lola, don't touch that, don't do that. And it's just all of that. And I come back sometimes and I just feel exhausted from it, because it's just, it's so overstimulating. They're really busy, really noisy. And just trying to, obviously with Lola's, probably class her as being like pre-verbal. So she does have some words, but she can't always use them like in context. So even like if another child speaks to her, and then she doesn't speak back and they like look and think, why are you not speaking to me? Do you not want to play with me? So me having to go around and explain all of that. So yeah, there's just so many things that we have to think about when we're going anywhere. So if I go somewhere, say like with a friend and with the children, I'm not going to be able to sit there and have a chat with them. That's not going to happen, because I will have to be constantly around Lola.
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? I'm at a slightly different stage. So, I mean, Leo's three, I probably wouldn't just let him run off anyway.
Yeah.
But mobility-wise, the likelihood is that it currently, I mean, he's walking, but he is delayed in, like, he isn't running, he isn't jumping. Yeah. There's certain things, like, in terms of climbing that probably typical children his age would be able to do in a soft play.
Yeah.
So mobility-wise, I can't really leave him, because he will get stuck.
Yeah.
And need help.
Yeah.
But also, I suppose I'm still at the stage where we can go to smaller things where I can see him. Like, I don't know if all of the Dobbies over the country are the same, but the play centre in our Dobbies in Liverpool is absolutely tiny.
Yeah.
But he still enjoys it because he's only little. So I can sit and drink a cup of coffee there because I can see him and I can get to him super quickly.
Yeah.
If he gets stuck. His current thing is he loves the slide. But he doesn't love the slide. So he loves the idea of a slide. So he's desperate to sit at the top of it, but it's terrified to go down. Aww. So he would just sit at the top in the way.
Yeah, so everyone's
like, there's like a queue of children behind him. And I'm like, yeah, he's not going to go down. And he's like cheering other people on, but they're having to like climb over the top of him. So I suppose all those different stages, the opportunity to sit there and have that cup of tea with the other parents is just not there, is it?
No, definitely not. But I don't know if I'd already spoken to you about this, but or it's a place that you've been to, but our favourite is Lumiere, which is the new SEN play centre that's opened in Liverpool. And I know there's people listening from all over the country, but there's people that have travelled from all over the country to go there. It's only for SEN children and their siblings, but actually there I can take a little bit of a step back, because everyone is in a very similar situation. You can see the whole play centre from where sort of like the tables are, and the staff come out and help. They actually get involved. They'll be in the ball pit with them, on the slides with them.
Not Leo.
Yeah, it's absolutely lovely. And like Lola was a little bit the same when we first went there. They've got the tunnel slides. And she just stood at the top and was like looking down. It was like, no. And I was having to like sort of like force her down. And now she'll climb up it, slide back down, and just she just absolutely loves it. She'd built that confidence up there to have a go. So having a place like that, and say they should be, that should be everywhere, shouldn't it? Because, you know, what is it, like one in five children now has got SEND. So
yeah.
Having those places, it shouldn't be that we think, oh, we're really lucky to have it. That should be the norm, shouldn't it, that every city has it?
It's interesting that you were saying, because I'd never really thought about it like this, like you are able to have a nicer time.
Yeah.
Somewhere like that. It was when you said about the cans of Coke. I hadn't really thought about it in terms of that before, because if you are at a dedicated SEND play centre or a SEND session somewhere, and that's actually where we met, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a SEND session messy play. No one's going to bat an eyelid if, you know, your child goes up and tries to swipe a drink or, you know, Leo is partial to a cuddle with people he doesn't know, especially men. He's obsessed with men. And, you know, sometimes we're out and I'm like, oh my God, please, like, stop trying to climb. Yeah. And it just makes it really awkward, doesn't it? And I suppose in those sessions, I hadn't really, because currently Leo doesn't really have sensory needs like that.
Yeah.
So I'm quite able to take him. I don't need those SEND sessions. Mm-hmm. And although they would be nice, actually, to go to, I feel like I don't want to take up a place that somebody else could have. Because like you've highlighted, they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you're going to a SEND session, there's going to be considerably less people, which means that those sessions are more in demand, aren't they? So that it's kind of why I haven't really dipped my toe in there, because a few people have mentioned Lumiere to me and how amazing it is. Mm-hmm. And I would like to go, but I kind of don't want to take the place up of somebody else that would need it more than I would.
Yeah, yeah, no, I get what you're saying. But honestly, especially like with things like with building confidence for them and just like having a go on the slides and you not having to worry that, you know, there's there's a queue of children behind them. So yeah, I think it's there, isn't it? And it's something that people can access as and when they need to. A lot of people that I speak to, they talk about how SEND sessions might be every 6 weeks on a Monday night, and it's like no one wants to go and do that. Then that's not when we need it. We need them to be regularly, don't we? And something that we can all access.
And how do you find that? Because I know that you obviously, and I'll put this in the show notes and I'll tag you and everything, but you've actually got an Instagram page that is all about this, about SEND places to go, SEND friendly places, places that will cater for additional needs. How do you find it? How easy, and I love that you're sharing that information, by the way, how easy have you found it though, to find those places and those sessions?
Initially, it was really difficult, but now I just feel like I'm finding more and more, or I'm contacting places and they've not got anything, and then they go, actually, is there a demand for that? And I'm like, yeah, definitely. I know, like, I feel like if you put a SEND session out now, you'd have it booked within minutes, because the demand is there. It's huge, because, as I say, people want to feel like, and sometimes it is more like, feel almost like selfish saying this, but it's sometimes it is more the parents like having that fear rather than the kids, because like I know Lola would be quite happy in many places, but I would be stressed, and then if I'm stressed, then it's going to have an impact on her, isn't it? So I know that if I go to places and other people are in the same position, They won't bat an eyelid.
I don't think that's selfish at all, though. I think, you know, you shouldn't have a dreadful time just so your child can have a nice time.
Yeah.
Like, it should be something that's nice for everybody. Yeah. You're already doing something. Like, as an adult, you're not going to choose to go to a soft play. Like, you're already, you know, taking her to something lovely that's for her. I think you should be entitled to have, like, at least a slightly relaxing time while you're there as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's something that I speak to a lot of places about, because sometimes they'll try and charge me for going on the equipment, and I'm like, I'm not doing it because I want to go on an inflatable or I want to go on a trampoline. I'm not doing it for my fun. I'm doing it because I need to be there to make sure she is safe. So there are a lot of places now I've started to offer like carers tickets for free, But some just still won't do it. They will say, like, oh no, you have to pay because you're using the equipment. So yeah, that can be a bit of a barrier. But say a lot of places now are going, yeah, that's fine.
It's an interesting point that actually. So there's two things that I've accessed with Leo. You'll know about these, Steph, I'd imagine. But for people that don't, there's the National Trust carer's card.
Yeah.
Do you know what? That was really easy to get. I don't know why I haven't mentioned this on the podcast before. So if you have a child with a disability, you literally just have to email them. I'm sure you'll be able to find the email address on the website somewhere for National Trust. And you get a little paper card. So your child gets in for free, don't they? And then they get one adult or one carer to go with them.
Yeah.
And I think in the summer, they're lovely places to go, the National Trust places for the gardens and things like that. Yeah, so we've accessed those a couple of times with Leo. And I've also, I don't know if you need this or not, I've got one of the carers cards to get the discount.
Yeah.
But it's the same at Aunt Towers.
Yeah.
So we took Leo to CBeebies Land for his birthday, which was really lovely. Yeah. And because we were able to go in the week, me and Ben took the day off work, there was literally nobody there. So if you did have a child who needed it to be quieter and wouldn't tolerate queues very much, I could recommend going in October in the week because it was absolutely dead. And then one of us didn't have to pay. And Aunt Towers is expensive.
Yeah.
So I think all of those little things do help, don't they? Those little hacks are good to know.
Yeah, definitely. And in places like theme parks, they will have like rides, access passes, like we used it at CBeebies when we went over Christmas last year, and it's basically like virtual queuing, so it's not just like you queue jumping. You just get like a time on a card when to come back, so you don't have to queue up. We know we need to go there at 2 o'clock and we can go straight on the ride then.
Do you know what? They told us about that when we were there and it was completely irrelevant to us because, like I said, I think the longest we queued was about 3 minutes in the night garden. There was quite literally nobody there. But things like that are really helpful to know, I think, you know, if it is busier, like Halloween or Christmas or over the summer. But we had a really nice interaction with a guy at Alton Towers, actually. He was on... he was, you know, with the people that help you get on and off the rides. He was one of those people. And I think with Down syndrome, it's usually you can probably tell that somebody has Down syndrome. You know, most people have, you know, quite physical characteristics of it.
Yeah.
And the way in which he phrased it to us was absolutely lovely. And I think I'm always keen to highlight when somebody has had a really positive experience.
Yeah.
And as we got off the ride, the man said to us, oh, does the young man have a disability? And I thought, what a lovely way to ask.
Yeah.
And the reason that he asked was to tell us about that ride access thing.
Yeah, that's absolutely lovely, that, isn't it? And it's just about people noticing and being positive. Like we had the swim baths, we'd gone, and because we haven't been for a couple of months, Lola was a little bit overwhelmed when we first got in and she was covering her ears. And the lifeguards come over and said, do you want me to turn the music down a little bit? So we were like, oh, yeah, if you can. So he turns it down. He went to just noticed. So we were like, oh, yes, please. So he turns it down and she absolutely loved it then. She had the best time. So just him noticing that and just a very small gesture that's not going to make any difference to anybody else's day made a huge difference to our day.
I love that. And it's nice to know that that is happening as well, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So, Steph, I finish the podcast with the same two questions each time. And the first one is, what is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
It's probably something that... my husband says to me quite a lot, and I think it must have come from a professional one time, but he has to remind me, because even though I know all of this, I sometimes forget and I might get a little bit carried away with certain things. And he's like, right, we need to follow her lead. What is it she wants to do? Because I realise that sometimes she might be playing with something in a certain way and I'll be like, oh, try this. And it's like, well, no, actually, she wants to do it that way. So we need to let her. And in terms of like day to day. What does she want to do? Does she want to have a chill morning? So I think that's probably the best piece of advice. And I say my husband always reminds me of it because I do forget. It's just about following your child's lead and seeing, exploring with them, seeing what they want to do. And I think that really helps to like build a connection as well.
I think that's good advice for parenting in general, actually.
Yeah.
I'm dreadful for building up an image in my head of what something's going to look like and how it's going to go.
Yeah.
And then when it doesn't go like that, I then have a slight freak out in my head.
Yeah.
And actually, it's good to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
And I will take that on board. So thank you, Steph, and thank you to your husband as well. And my final question is, what do you know now that you wish you'd known either when you got Lola's diagnosis or when you started on that pathway to diagnosis?
The main thing, especially when during the start of the pathway, to build a community of other SEND mums. And actually, we have a WhatsApp chat called the SEND Mum Club, which is quite funny. So we have that community. So I think that's what I've gone back and told myself. Find people that have walked a similar path, are going through the same thing. So like we'll message each other like, are they asleep yet? Or, you know, what was last night like? You know, that sort of thing. And we all know we're in the same position. We'll tell like stories and we'll just laugh with each other. So I think having people that are in that same situation, just giving advice and giving ideas. I feel like a lot of the stuff that I've learned is from other parents rather than from like, I know when we got the diagnosis, we got given like a piece of paper with, oh, look on these websites. And then that was it pretty much. But I've learned so much from other parents and they've gone, oh, we've tried this, have you tried that? And I'm like, no, never heard of that. And then that's how I've learned most of what I know, most of what we do day to day.
I love that. Steph, before you go, what is your Instagram? So if people are, you know, in the same area as me and you, which is Merseyside, they can kind of see the places that you are going to and the places that are suitable for children with additional needs.
So it's incredible_SEN_adventures.
And I will make sure that's in the show notes.
Thank you.
And Steph, I've really enjoyed our chat. Thanks so much for coming on.
Nice to see you again.
You too.
Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed that chat with Steph, my first one of the year. And I thought it was really interesting what she was saying and the advice that she was able to give and the insight into the support for children with additional needs and specifically autism post 16, because I guess maybe that's something that you haven't considered. Maybe that's somewhere you're not able to go in your head yet. But I found kind of what she said quite comforting. I know that my son has Down syndrome, but it you know, it falls under that same umbrella, isn't it? Of will he be able to get a job? Is there the support there? Are there people that want to help? And the answer seems to be yes. So that has made me personally feel a little bit more hopeful about that kind of situation looking into the future. And I also thought it was brilliant that Steph has been contacting places and getting them to offer SEND sessions. And they've actually said, yes, it does feel like things are becoming more inclusive like that. So yeah, a great episode. I hope you enjoyed it. And Steph was one of those people that slid into my DMs and said that she'd love to come on the podcast. And there she was. So if you're thinking about it and you're thinking, oh, do I want to come on? Yes, you do. And I'd love to have you as well. So you can slide into my DMs if you want to at the SEND Mum Club on Instagram. Or, you know, if you want to suggest a friend or an account that you follow that you found really helpful, all suggestions very much welcome. Just before I go, I do need to say, if you wouldn't mind leaving a little review, a rating, maybe following or subscribing if you aren't already, all of that is free to do, by the way. It just helps more people find the podcast. So that's it. I will be back next week with another great guest for you. Hopefully see you then.